So let us start. First thing, before I forget, there are the exercises I mentioned last time, and I published the first exercise sheet. It's on the web page. Hopefully everyone has found it. And you're supposed to work in triples, so group together. What else? Is there any questions about it? I don't know if you just maybe have taken a look at it, if it looks clear, doable. So there's the Haskell exercises, which is the very last one, which indicates that eventually we are going to prepare some ground for Haskell programming. And since the deadline is the next week already, so this should happen in between. And I hope that we can do it on next, so basically tomorrow. So if you come with your laptops, this will be welcome, because we are going to do some examples. All right, so and back to the lecture. So first, some errata to the previous lecture. I made a mistake by claiming that the rules for ifs are different for call by value and call by name. That was actually not true. Sorry for that. I've checked this. Apparently, there is some sort of laziness in the if construction, which is present both in call by name and call by value. And in call by name, in call by value, we still have this effect that we evaluate the condition to true. I mean, if we evaluate the condition to true, then we do not care about the other program. So we just evaluate P. So this is more or less a minor thing, but there is a more serious thing where I also have mistaken last time. And well, first I recall the notion of a value. As so, it's one of the following options. First option, it's this unique element of the union. Of the terminal type, I don't remember how I called it. So it's this type which contains one element only. So then there are numbers, and there are booleans. And so this is the place where we get recursive, because we say that value is a pair of values where values are recursively defined. And that I probably forgotten this time. So a lambda abstraction is also a value, which for the reason we discussed before, that it's irreducible. And for a technical reason, it's very convenient in defining semantics. And then evaluation relation is defined in such a way that P is an arbitrary program and C is a value, and in the sense of the above definition. And I gave the rules for products, which were something like something like this. So if t reduces to c1, c2, then pr1 of t reduces to c1. And under the same assumptions, assumption, pr2 reduces to c2. So this is in call by value. So I showed these rules last time, they were correct. But the situation with call by name is considerably more different because in call by name, we reduce to the things which are values in a different under a different definition. So I can summarize this also by in the same style. So some things are the same. And then so this is the difference. So okay. And here I also have to add that so we consider this lambda abstraction to be values only if they are closed terms. And here the same. So the only clause which is different here, a value is a pair of values. And here a value is an arbitrary pair of closed terms. This is a feature of call by name, which additionally says that we are lazy in pairs. So and call by value, we have a, pairs to be, we consider as values only pairs of values because we evaluate both components of them. And call by name, we are lazy in the sense that if we meet a product, we don't look inside before we eventually need these components in the rules like this. That's why we are lazy again. So laziness and called by name are used as synonyms. And this has an impact on these rules for called by name. So they look differently. Called by name, say PQ. And I want to check PR 1t. So this is not it because I evaluated to two closed terms, but to evaluate PR2, I need to additionally evaluate P because that was not finished in call by name. So I need to evaluate to C, and hence I get C as the result. That's a very similar phenomenon that we considered with evaluating lambda abstraction. So for example, you can again do the comparison between call by name and call by value using this omega divergent term. So in I can, no, I can't. So analogous now for PR2. And we can consider terms like PR1, P omega, or let's just take something concrete like 1. So if I calculate the semantics of this in call by name, then I get just 1. And in call by value, this diverges. So basically, I cannot form this judgment for any value. And this effect is also called strictness. So we now, we'll soon continue with denotational semantics. And there are parallels all the time. So we use the bottom elements for domains and this divergence symbol in operational semantics. And there are functions which diverge when the arguments diverge, and there are functions which doesn't diverge when the argument, even if the argument diverges. So, and the function which diverge when their arguments diverge, they are also called strict. So in call by value, our products are strict, and in call by name, they are lazy. So we might converge even if the arguments diverge. And for completeness, I'm not sure if I gave the rules for the fixed points. We have discussed them, but just for completeness. I do not need such a long line, it's very short. So you might have noticed that the semantics for call by name is most of the times much simpler. That has something to do with the reason we have discussed in the very beginning, like they calculate the same normal forms as the lambda calculus, and lambda calculus is a very mathematically elegant formalism, and it's more elegant when you start doing something with it. So, and the semantics is very elegant. So if you want to calculate the fixed points, you just unfold it once, calculate the result, and that result is the semantics of a fixed point. And because of the laziness, we do not have any unwanted effects here. In contrast to call by value, which I explained previously, that if we try to do the same, then we would just always diverge because application is strict. Now I can use this term, and we would keep unfolding the argument, and we would do it infinitely long. So instead of that, in call by value, you use an equivalent term to that one, but this divergence doesn't happen. Because formally it's a value, so it doesn't unfold anymore. Okay, and then I wanted to come back to the denotational semantics. We have considered several constructions. There are not much more, we don't need to study much more than those which I have presented. Basically, we just need to add one more. Yeah, so back to that lifting construction. So we had these two operations. So this operation, which goes from, say, D bottom, which just adds the bottom. And there is another construction, which is star, which essentially creates a function like this from a function like this. This point at E, which is important here. By the way, I could also mention that in this context, CPOs or pointed CPOs are often called domains and not pointed are called predomains. That's a common jargon, but the thing is, pointed CPU is a formal notion, but a domain is not a formal notion, because There are very different sorts of structure which people call domains in the literature. Normally, they consider some more restricted structures than CPOs and call them domains. But if we stick to this one, we can just call them domains and predomains, because this is the structures that we are using presently. So here, this construction basically says how to lift a function from a predomain to a domain. And there was this notation which is actually quite useful. Let x p in q. And by definition, that was, what was this? Lambda x q star p. And the intuition of it is that we try to evaluate p, which might be a program which can diverge, like in our operation rules. And if it doesn't diverge, then we run q. Otherwise, we diverge altogether. That's the intuition. And this construction will be very helpful. And the first example, when it's helpful, I can show already now. This is it provides an easy way to lift operations which we all know to this realm of domains and predomains. Like, we are next going to form the semantics of PCF, and that features booleans and natural numbers, but natural numbers and booleans, they live in sets, they do not live in CPOs. So, and there are operations attached to them which are set theoretic, like conjunction, disjunction, things like that, but we'll need to interpret them over CPOs. So how to do it? So this construction helps us to do it. For every, let's say, op from x1, well, okay, let's just consider binary operations. Our operations are all binary, at most binary. You can think of this as conjunction, for example. With x, y, z being sets. So we know how this operation is defined because we know the meaning of these operations. And now we want to lift them to domains, how we do it. So we define op bottom, x bottom times y bottom to z bottom. So these are now domains. I just joined the divergence everywhere. Why I need it is because I keep messing up the operations, the traditional operations with the operational operation of lambda calculus. Lambda calculus produces divergence, which is our bottom. And I need the operations which are aware of the bottom. So I need the operations which would tell me if I diverge, what would be the result. And this would be a candidate. How I define such an operation, I just use the set construction. Op bottom xy, or let's say pq is equal to let p in let q in p op x, y, and I inject it everything here. So how does it work? Like expected, if I take an argument and that argument happens to be divergence, that I diverge, then I take the other argument, if it's again divergence, I again diverge. And otherwise, if I came to this point, I was so lucky to come here, I just take my old, good old operation and return it and make sure that I don't diverge by using these brackets. So this is a generic way to lift operations from set domains in a strict way. So that notion of strictness that I explained, it would apply to all operations defined in this way, because if we diverge in one of the arguments, then the whole result diverges, and this is what we expect. Because we don't want our operations lifted from sets to control the divergence. So because divergence is controlled by the control structure, like if and while and so things like that, and if you just use arithmetic operations, they should be strict in the sense that if the argument diverges, then everything diverges. So this is the first use of this operation. And then there is the last domain construction or construction over CPU, which is called function space. Or functional spaces. And it's defined like this. Let A and B be two CPUs, and then function space CPU, where, okay, we use this notation, but this notation is not an arrow over sets. It has a special meaning in this context. It's a set of all such set theoretic functions, so this notation a bit clashes. So we use this, the same, but this is the only place. So I gave the notion of continuity last time. And it's very important. So if we stick to CPOs, then everything we construct must be a CPO, and every function between CPO must be continuous. So therefore, it shouldn't be a surprise that when we form the domain for functions, then it must consist only of those functions which are continuous. And f is smaller than g, so I refer to this approximation relation. If and only if for every x, f of x is smaller than g of x. So this is called pointwise definition. So it's like for tuples. So if you compare two tuples, then one is smaller than the other if they're component wise smaller. So and if you just consider a function to be a big tuple, then one is smaller than the other if for every component of the tuple, the corresponding value of the function is smaller. I think very simple. And then there are two canonical operations. So Kari, I don't know if you know. So this is the in functional programming. If you already do some functional programming, this is a very common primitive. It's named after Haskell Kari, I think a co-inventor of lambda calculus, possibly at least a researcher who investigated it a lot. And Haskell is also named after him because Haskell is his name and Kari is his surname. So this is an operation which takes two CPUs. Well, it takes this function space from A times B to C and construct a function space from A to So if we have a function of two arguments, then we can form a function which takes the first argument and returns a function which takes the second argument and then returns the result. So formally, Kari f. So how I define it? This f, and Kari returns a function like this. How to say how it's defined, I give the argument x, and the result is again a function from B to C. So to define this function, I provide the second argument, y, and the result of that is just f of x, y. So one of the reasons why mathematically, we do not necessarily need Cartesian products in lambda calculus, like in those very first versions which you present in the beginning, is because of this. So whenever you have a function of two arguments, you just can convert it into a function of one argument, which returns a function of yet another argument. So this is how we can get rid of many arguments, but of course, products are still important, and we want them. So instead of eliminating all multivariable functions, we just let them coexist and provide a conversion between them. So this was the first function, and the other function is called f, or evaluation. We take something coming from a function space and A, and construct, well, and return B. So how we do it, we take f, so f and x, and return f of x. And you could just use this instead of f, but we want to make it explicit, because this composition is just a set theoretic composition, because every function from this function space is a set theoretic function, and we can apply a set theoretic function to an argument and to get a set. So, but by using this f, we want to emphasize that it's not just a theoretic application, but it's indeed a function for CPOs. And indeed, one can prove that fact, that just like in all the previous cases, Cary and f are continuous. Right, so we have functions between domains. All this CPOs we have constructed before. We know how to form a product and a function. So these are two CPOs, and Cary technically just is a map between two CPOs. And so is f. So you can see that f is takes two arguments. How we treat functions of two arguments, well, we treat it just in a function of one argument, which is a pair. And as we showed before, we can pair CPOs, and the result is also CPO. So this is all well-defined, and you can talk about continuity of the things. So it's not a terribly difficult task to verify that this is actually continuous. It's just for the sake of saving time, do not do it. Then there is yet another important point. Well, basically, the next thing is a fixed point theorem. Linear fixed point theorem. This basically the first place where all the theory that we have developed actually pays off, because everything which we've done, which have done so far, it's the same what we could do in set theory. So we could form pairs, we could form function spaces. We could do all this, but we restricted from sets to CPOs. And so far, I didn't explain how this is used. And this is used in the theorem, which can be proved only in these settings, but which we wouldn't be able to prove in sets. So let F be a continuous function with point at D. Then, first thing we can prove is that this function has a least fixed point. So there is mu f, which we call least fixed point, such that. So it's a list fixed point, which is justified by the following statements. So first property of it is that f of mu of f is equal to mu f, which is which says that it's the fixed point, just like that fixed point operator we considered in the operational semantics. And the second property is for every x in D, if f of x is equal to x, then mu of x is smaller than x. That's the second part, which says that it's a least fixed point, the smallest one. But this is not not it. In fact, we can calculate this fixed point constructively in the following way. So mu f is this least upper bound of this function f I bottom, where f I of no f zero is just bottom, and f I plus 1 of x is equal to f of f I of x. So I can calculate this least fixed point by iterating f. So I apply it to bottom, and iterated several times, and then I find all such iteration and find the least upper bound.
Shouldn't f zero x be x function?
No. Well, yeah, actually, yes. You're right. Sorry. Yeah. Yes, standardly it's X. So this is maybe not very clear, but as I said previously, the whole idea of denotational semantics is to use the ordering as a metaphor for.
Can you tell me which the second last line on the upper board is the second last?
Second last.
Which I can't.
Mu f smaller, so this is this. So we wanted to use this approximation relation as a metaphor for information increase. And the bottom is like zero information. And when we form a sequence and next is greater than the previous, it's like increasing the information. And then we form this least upper bound, it's like the union of all the information that we have collected. I might have explained it from a different perspective. So for example, I have a sequence of functions, well, f0, f1, and so on, infinitely many, where fi goes from n bottom to n bottom. So n is natural numbers. and I define f0. Is equal to bottom for every x, and f1 of x equal to f1 of 0 equal to 1, and f1 of x equal to bottom if x is greater than 0. And f2 of 0 equal to 1, f2 of 1 equal to 1, f2 of x equal to bottom if x is greater than 1. Yes, and f3 say 1, 1, and f3 of 2. Okay, it's a bit lengthy. Again, 2, and f3 of x is equal to bottom if x is greater than 2. So f4. So this just repeats. And now f3, no, f4 of 3 is equal to 6. And again, f4x is equal to bottom if x is greater than 3. And so on. You see already what function I'm trying to define, I guess. Don't you?
The faculty function?
Yes. Factorial. So these are my approximations. Like these iterations or in the Clini's theorem. Because I'm looking at the sequence as a sort of sequence when every next function is defined over a bigger set, and I hope that in the limit I get my whole factorial function. So first thing, it's easy to see, it's easy to prove. That every next function, every next function is greater than the previous one. So if you just take the definition, we're given the definition of this function spaces. Okay, so first thing which is easy to see, it's every function f I is continuous. So that's the first thing we need to check to be able to do anything. And then it's easy to see that every next function is greater than the previous function. So I can implement this idea of defining factorial by saying that f is just this limit of these functions. And in fact, I can prove that f of n is equal to n factorial. Because for every n, there is a component here for which the factorial is defined. And then when I find the limit, then it's defined for every n. And a different, another observation about it is that actually f y I plus 1 is of x is equal to f of f So I can basically consider this definition again and see that this every next function is defined using the previous one and using f, where f of x is equal to 1 if x equal to 1 and x times f x minus 1 if x greater than 1. So apparently, this function implement my recursive definition of a factorial because it calls itself. So this is the standard mathematical definition of a factorial. And I can get this approximation just by iterating it. And I can consider this way of defining my approximation as, I can consider this approximation as stemming from this recursive definition involving f. So, and what Kleene's theorem does for me, it actually relates this to words. It says that basically f is the least fixed point. So I look at this definition as like a functional which gets an argument and applies f to this argument. So this is my big f, it takes g and it applies f to g. So, and then my factorial function is the least fixed point of this functional. And I get all these equations due to Kleene's theorem. So my factorial function is the least fixed point of this f, which is the least upper bound of this chain, and which is the least upper bound of my approximations. So this can be calculated.
There are two different small f there, aren't there? Otherwise, this whole thing is circular.
Which one? This one?
On the right.
No, it's that one.
Yes, so there are two Fs, two small Fs.
No, this F and that F are the same Fs.
Yes, but not one on the left and the last line.
This one?
No.
On the left.
This one.
This one. This
yeah,
one.
It's... it's the same one, yes.
Then this is circular.
Yeah, it's circular because it's not a definition, it's a property. So you can define... So, yes.
I think it doesn't work because fi of x, if fi of x is not bottom, it is the factorial of x. Yes? And then we apply f, which gives us the factorial of the factorial, but then it's not the factorial anymore.
I didn't see the point.
So in the first line we define
yes.
fi plus 1 of x, and if we assume x is already not, so fi does not map x to the bottom, but to the factorial of x, then we apply f, then we have the factorial of
ah, yeah, okay. Yes, there's something wrong here. So this was wrong, yes. So f is the body of the factorial. No. Yes, something. So what I meant by FG was FG of X is equal to 1 if X equal to 1 and X times G of X minus 1 if X greater than 1. So yeah, maybe this definition was wrong. Yeah, okay. Is this better?
Not really.
because now I'm not using the F. Yeah, which must be all right. Okay, so there is no small f anymore, which is fine.
So the top you still wrote going to apply the small f.
Hmm? Where? Here?
No, in the definition of f I plus 1.
Here?
You still apply f to the
top. Okay, right. So what was meant is this, right? Yeah, sorry for that. Right, this is the body. This is the body of my factorial function. It calls.
So now we really got rid of the small f.
Yeah, actually, f is something we define. I mean, the point of this definition is that when you write such a thing, we can imagine that we don't know if it's a well-defined thing or not, because there is a recursion, and we need to check somehow that the recursion is well-founded. So this actually, this F, which I obtained by the Kleene's fixed point theorem. So when I write this, I basically say that this F was correctly defined and it's equal to that. Thank you. Okay, yeah. That's the illustration to that theorem. Okay, another thing finally, yet another effect. Mu, if we consider mu as a function from d to d to d, is continuous. That's not our standard observation, because as I said, we need to make sure that everything is continuous. So, and then with all this developed, we can proceed with the semantics of call by name, for example. So we'll need one auxiliary thing. Just very technical, cont. So this is just a map which is used to interpret the if constructor. And of course, we will also need to know that it continues.
Can you put on the apple for it?
So as I said, call by name is simpler and mathematically elegant. So the semantics provided those things we have developed before. It's more or less easy. So we'll need to interpret the types. So we define this assignment for the types. So we say that the semantics of natural is this flat domain, and the semantics of a pair A times B is just the semantics of A cross the semantics of B. So you can see that I repeat the constructions on the left and on the right. Okay, we also had what? For Booleans, this is all just the same. And for one, it's just one bottom. So if we have just normal domains, with just normal sets, data types, then we just adjoin bottom, lift them, and consider it to be domain. So I can repeat the same symbols on the left and on the right. But again, so these are different things. These are just formal sign from the type assignments. And this X is the construction of domains, which we have just considered recently. And this is the function space, which we considered just before. So we assign the semantics like this. Then you remember we had contexts. Which were just lists of pairs, a variable in type. So a semantics of a context is just the product of the semantics of the types it involves. So that's why it's practical to have this context to be lists, because we can directly transfer them to products. Otherwise, we will have liberty to choose the order and how to choose it. So for every term in context, we define the semantics of this term as is what? As a function, continuous function. Well, first I say what it is, and then I say how it's defined. So a semantics of a term in context will be a function, a continuous function, from this object to this object. Of course, we want to interpret terms as functions from arguments to the target. And this is, of course, the most crucial place. So we define the semantics by induction of the term structure of it, of T. So what's going on here? We start from the easy cases like the semantics of of this unit type. So I add this rule. So since this is a function, I want to define it by its value on this argument. So this gamma belongs to the semantics of gamma, and gamma is a tuple. So rho is a tuple which belongs to a product type. So if I want to define this function, it's just equal to this, because this corresponds to a flat domain. So I just lift this flat domain by these brackets, and this is the result. So then I have what true, for example, this is of type bool. And of course, I define it in the same way. So analogously, for false and natural numbers. Then there are operations. So my data types, they come with operations like a conjunction, for example. And the semantics of this is simply op bottom . Okay, forgot the rules. Clear so far? Now there is the semantics of variables. So what would be a semantic of a variable? Well, this is the variable which I must have introduced with the corresponding rule. So a variable I introduce when they belong to gamma. So gamma contains all three variables, and x is obviously free here. So to define this semantics, I just need to project rho to the corresponding place where this x occurs in gamma. So it's actually So I just no PR row. So my row is a tuple, and I look for my x where it occurs in this tuple, and I return the projection. So it's eth component of this tuple. Yet another thing which is easy is if B, then P else Q. This is equal to cond. So this is why I defined this cond, because I wanted to use it here. Okay, so if is interpreted as expected, so then there is application. Yeah, okay, switch the order in button, it doesn't matter. So I use this evaluation function from the function spaces. So I have S, which goes from B to A, row, and there's yet another row here. All right. Apparently, it should have used a different order. So a simpler thing is the pairs. ST. So I invite you to compare this with the rules of the operational semantics, because the denotational semantics and operational semantics, they are two sides of the same coin. And that comment about the product which I made before, you can actually see how it applies here. So I wanted to say that my products are lazy, meaning that I do not check if my arguments diverge to form the pair. And this is precisely what you see here. So to find the semantics of a pair, I find the semantics of its argument and form the pair. I do not check if I diverge or not. This is very different from the behavior of the call-by-value semantics. So then there are projections. And projections are projections. So okay, let me just index this by letters. So I don't use want to write this rule twice for I1 and I2. So I just use the indices where A is equal 1, 2. So we take the corresponding component of the pair. Yeah, and what I said about the compositional semantics somewhere in the beginning, you can basically see it here very clearly, because most of the constructions, they just transform to themselves. And hence, it's in a clear way compositional, but it doesn't mean, when we say compositional semantics, that it need not be that simple. The relation may be more complicated, but in the Kolbauer name case, it's very straightforward. And then there are lambda xt a to b rho is equal to curry No, actually differently. So that's probably the only place where I don't want to use the rho as an argument, because rho correspond to a product of my context with, or no, actually not. So it's like this. So here I have, when I calculate the semantics of an argument, it's a product of gamma and A. So I can apply my curry function to shift this argument to the exponential. So what we have covered, everything except y, I think. So how we define the semantics of this, of the fixed point? Well, we call the Kleene's theorem. Right now, by Kleene's theorem, I can find the least fixed point of this function. And that's how I interpret my fixed point. So I interpret fixed points as least fixed points. And this is justified by this intuition about the bottom element being the smallest amount of information that I have. So, and then I find the approximation, like in that example that I found, and then the semantics of a loop or recursion is the least upper bound of this chain, which approximate my target function from below. So I guess I didn't forget anything here, right? And I wanted to give the semantics of call by value before we start doing something with practical. But apparently I cannot do it today, so I have to postpone it until tomorrow. So we will, I will present a semantic for call by value. And then we start looking at the relation of all this to the way it's implemented in Haskell. Draw some relation to this. All right. So is there any question to this? All right. Then this is it.